Today I am talking with David Kidder, who is the CEO of Clickable. David's located in New York, and Clickable is a paperclip company. So, David, maybe you could take it away and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Great to connect with you. Based in New York City, the founder and CEO, as you mentioned, Clickable, and we like to think of ourselves as the kind of Apple of online advertising platforms. So basically a very simple tool that takes the complexity and time of managing online advertising across all the major networks, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and others. So we're about to expand that into the social space. So we're excited. About 130 people in the company. We'll add about 100 people in the next 12 months. It's growing very fast. Raised a bunch of VC money, about $20 million from some SVCs on the East Coast and then in Silicon Valley. Same venture capitalists behind Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and others. So we have great contacts on both coasts. And we're growing fast. It's a lot of fun. This is my third company. So I've been building companies since I graduated from university. I built a mobile advertising firm, built a 500-person internet agency in the 90s, and really enjoyed people and building teams and creating value both for investors and for the employees of the company, and had a great time doing that. So, also, I have two kids, two-and-a-half and four-year-old boy, Jack and Steven. Been married for 8 years to Johanna Zelstra, who's my wife. She's Dutch. And I have a third kid due in August this year, which is a total surprise and wild. And then I have a couple of side hobbies. One is a book series that I write called The Intellectual Devotional. And we do it at Rodale. It's basically a book series. Our fifth book comes out in the spring in May. It's basically 5-minute-a-day readings to kind of renew your mind. And two of the books have been New York Times bestsellers and a lot of fun. And I have a nonprofit called Good Ads, G-O-D-A-D-S, which is a partnership with GE and NBC and William Promise, which helps use corporate branding to market cause products. So from malaria nets to inoculations to medics, we help use big branding dollars to kind of greed what is good, so to speak. And we use banner ads and traffic and celebrities to move attention to actual people buying or purchasing or endorsing cause products that actually do, you know, real meaningful good every single day. So those are the big things. Clickable and the book series, Intellectual Devotional and Good Ads are kind of professionally speaking and nonprofit, and then family, kids, the rest of my life. So it's a lot and fun, and it's a really blessed and grateful life.
So usually 2 or 3 hours a night?
Pretty much. There's not a lot of sleep. Especially my wife right now, she's on her third floor, I'm on the second floor with two little kids, so it's probably on average, probably 5, I'd say, it's probably a good solid number.
And so you live in New York City?
I lived in New York City for about 10 years, and we bought an old Victorian home outside the city, about 18 miles outside the city in Westchester, just north of the city, and we rebuilt and stored this old Victorian for about a whole year, about 5-6 years ago. And so now with two little boys running around crazy, we've had a great time having light, space, and air and having them enjoy that. And so we have two dogs, and it's a nice break from the city. I mean, I drive the city every day, just 45 minutes, and I get kind of a quiet time in the car and listening to blogs and or podcasts and doing phone calls. So by the time I get home, I'm fully engaged with kids, and then I'm usually with them until about 9, and then they go to sleep and then work from 9 to 1 usually, so. It works.
And you didn't want to stay in the city? I mean, is there a reason why you didn't stay in the city with kids?
I love the city. I miss the city a great deal. I'm here every day, so I kind of get my fix. But the truth is, I think I want my kids to not experience. I think they always have the option to move to the city, but they don't have the option not to experience, you know, outdoors and cut grass and sports, and those are things that when I want my desire to live in the city to, you know, take away from their, you know, their growth experience, you know, outside of metropolitan environment. That's an option they can choose later in life.
Cool.
And it's something we might change our mind on, but right now with the kids, it works totally well.
But you have a 45-minute commute each way.
Yeah, it's actually can be, depending on how long you leave yourself in the morning to leave early, you can get here quicker, but I'd say on average that's about the commute. But my time is fairly organized. I have an amazing assistant, Susan Green, who used to work at AOL with Bob Pittman's assistant and Mike Kelly's assistant for about 10 years. And so she makes every hour or two by, booking things really tightly and organized and putting call lists. And so we get a lot done, and then you kind of get a chance to decompress between, you know, the office and home. So it's a nice break.
Cool. Have you ever had a job?
Very good job. There was a time after I sold my last one. I started to create a college called Next, which we built, sold over 2 years. And then I joined to roll up a kind of dot-com company in the 90s back by Omnicom, which is the largest agency holding company in the world. And so during that period, I was part of a team. And so to the extent that was a job, the closest I've ever had one to one of that 3 years, you know, as part of a team, I worked with that group and that board doing that roll-up. So that was probably the closest I ever got. But I was very entrepreneurial, and I was an entrepreneur amongst other entrepreneurs of the management team. And it was a lot of fun. It was wild times in the 90s in New York to the dot-com era. It was very kind of Studio 54, big dollars and crazy. So it was a great period to be in the dot-com boom.
Did you retire at the beginning?
No, you know, I didn't make money, which was great. I don't ever see myself retiring. I think money is not the reason why I work. I love to create and innovate, and a lot of my travel in the world has kind of influenced my belief on that we have all in a lot of ways. If we have light, space, and safety, have already won humanity's lottery, and we have a responsibility to take risks, and I don't see myself stop doing that any one time. I'm not building companies, you know, so that I have a specific outcome that makes me, you know, me have more time for myself. I really want to create, so.
And so how did you use your food company? How did you go to food company to?
So the first one, NetX, about 10 people, sold that to a privately held company that was competing with Point Cashback and internal communications.
You know, you can buy the Point Cash main today for $1,000.
Is that what it is? It's hilarious.
Yeah,
it's yeah, it gives you an idea of how long it's been. That was 1996. We sold Think No Ideas, which was this roll-up for, I think, 225, to, and that company's actually still around. It's called Interthink. It's public and has about 2,000 to 3,000 employees. And then that was fun.
$225 million?
Yep, and then we did my company called SmartRay, which is a privately held company. We had about 40 people. We sold that for a little under $40 million after the .com crash. So, you know, had good solid stuff. There's no billion-dollar exit yet. I suspect that Clickable had a very good shot at doing that. I think this will be the biggest company I've had a chance of being, you know, founding and helping build. So we're on a very, very fast clip of growth at the scale we have. So I'm very excited about
building. So you did a Point Half knockoff, and you sold it for $225 million.
No, the point that was, it was actually in the 90s. The company that bought us, Target Vision, was doing communications inside corporations at the desktop and TV level. And so they had a very big footprint of corp Fortune 1000 companies in the United States, where they were the platform for internal corporate communications. And so Pointcast was coming out at the desktop level, if you remember, giving news and corporate information, as well as obviously, you know, general news. And so they bought my company, NetX, to help build the internet platform.
Oh,
yes, to compete with
wow.
them. And then after about a year, I left to go move back to New York, and do the roll-up that then became, we did a roll-up from, when I joined Red Republic, from 80 employees to 500, like in 2 years, we bought like 8 companies, and it was a wild run.
I'm really interested to understand. I mean, this is a really interesting perspective. You've been through the wild times of the .com era, and you weren't in Silicon Valley, but obviously you're interacting a lot with those guys, and you're in what I think of the capital of the world, New York.
Yeah.
How was it? I mean, obviously we know today in hindsight, and this is 10 years later, so it's easy to look back in hindsight and say, well, you know, those guys sucked and they're wrong. But nobody knew that back in the time. How did that feel when you were in? Did you doubt some of the stuff that was going on? I mean, how were these things happening when there wasn't a proper financial underpinning tool? Like, how did it feel? Were people doubting that, or was everyone like, this is the thing, we're just going to go for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were pretty all wide-eyed. I don't think that people realize that we were really the first generation of that technology. So the internet affected so many kind of public conscience minds, both privately and publicly, personally and professionally, that, you know, the hope was transformative across every sector. So you had everybody dazzled, whether it be a start person right down to your grandmother. You know, you had everybody who was touching the technology. So I think that's why the accentuation of that and the rise of those technology companies and the IPOs and stuff is so dramatic, that everyone wanted to be part of creating that and participating in that technology. It's not like, you know, nanotechnology or energy or, you know, derivative products where, you know, only 10 people know how to do it. Everybody understood it. And so very few technologies have that type of application that are not just an investment, they're a participating investment. That's why it got so kind of hyperbolic in its growth. You know, and by comparison, you know, .com boom looks like, you know, a small mistake compared to what Wall Street has done to Main Street. So it's important to have that context. That was, yes, you know, it was a discrete financial over-accentuation of value. Okay, great. So now they launched 500 IPOs and, you know, created, you know, $500 million of value and $1 trillion in value, and, you know, 75% went away. However, you know, you birthed, you know, very serious companies. You birthed Amazon, eBay, Google. You know, you built monsters. And you also invented the first generation companies to Facebook, like The Globe and Six Apart, who hold those patents to those next generation technologies where, you know, people and adoption behavior became real and did that. And so I think that first phase was a much economic hothouse as it was art hothouse. And it really did incubate you know, what is now the, you know, platform. You saw even this last week that it's the first year that there'll be more dollars spent digital advertising than analog. You know, e-commerce is going to be, you know, projected to $259 billion in total sales on those platforms across over the next 5 years. I mean, those are completely disruptive shifts in behavior and technology.
In that first decade, we had, as you mentioned, eBay, Amazon, Google, and a bunch of others. And in the following decade, we've only really had Facebook and potentially Twitter. There hasn't been a ton more that's come out of the second decade compared to the first decade.
Well, yeah, I mean, Google really straddled the decades. I mean, Google was born in 2001, 2002, and really went public in 2004 or 2005. So Google was born out of that, which is, you know, far and away, you know, the most dominant piece of technology ever created on the internet.
Google was formed in like 98, 99. Right?
I think it was actually 2000, 2001. I mean, it was in a university at that time. But by the time it was actually scaling, I mean, it was 2001, 2004, I think the revenue grew from like, you know, 7 million to 50, 60 million. And then after they created the auction, PPC, in 2004 is when they really exploded. But that was being incubated and started right, you know, after the whole kind of, you know, Yahoo going public, GoDaddy going public, all these companies were doing kind of directory-based search indexes. They just reinvented the second generation. So I kind of put them in that next bucket. But Chris is right. Chris is actually a friend and neighbor to us here in Silicon Alley, right across the street. I can probably see his office through here. But, you know, Chris is right in the sense that, you know, we have, you know, formative cultural and business changing businesses, and then but you still have businesses that are emerging. You know, YouTube is a transformative type of success that was not a fluke. You have smaller, less capital intensive businesses that may have not moved the economic needle, but they've moved behavior. And so the economic reward for behavior shift, Amazon, eBay, Google have been great. But there's also tons of other applications that maybe have not been worth $1 billion, but have created, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of behavioral value. I mean, take Craigslist, for instance. Craig Newell created that business. And he's been $50 to $100 million in revenue, and he destroyed a, you know, $5 billion business of the Yellow Pages. So, I mean, they are,
well, these Yellow Pages and Yellow Pages as well.
I mean, yeah, that's a great point. So as much as, I mean, as much destruction and disruption as has been economic value being created, ideologically speaking, the stack was created in the first iteration, and now everybody's building on a stack, building on APIs, less expensive businesses to create, maybe less economic reward at the exit. Still, I mean, huge disruptive value is being created all the time. Location-based technology.
Well, you know, I mean, the disruptive value is like maybe 10% of what was there before, right? I mean, Craig, you know, 50 to 100 million a year, but he's taking out newspapers and Yellow Pages, and he's the revenue he's generating. I mean, I guess it's value that's going up to society instead of being captured by corporations.
Yeah, it's and maybe that's not a bad thing. I think it's, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing personally. I think that's the change of, kind of, I don't think there's a dynastic evolution in technology. I think it's a disruptive and destructive technology evolution. And so it's the fact that, you know, that those mainstay companies who own media or own knowledge or, you know, those sort of things necessarily deserve or are in position culturally to maintain it. I think that destruction happens much faster. So the idea that, you know, suddenly the newspapers are the ones to figure out how to save their business before it drives off a cliff, that's a myth. You know, and that's not necessarily, I mean, you could have all the major newspapers drive off a cliff with no answer to the problem. And it could take a 10-year window to actually fix that problem. And it may not happen because, you know, all the journalists figure out how to monetize their skill. It could have to happen because a technology innovation like the iPad picks it up and runs with it, or the Kindle. It could be hardware related. So I just think we're in a highly volatile, high vibration moment where, you know, the owners of, you know, historical economic value for information, knowledge, technology, are on the hook for solving these problems, but are unlikely to solve them because of cultural bias and, talent.
Do you think you would be starting your third startup of Clickable today if you had been born in Nebraska and grew up in Nebraska?
It would be available to me. I think that the distance and proximity is not an impediment to starting companies. You know, I love market research. I said it's always a great time to start a company, good or bad markets. I do believe that location definitely influences the speed in which you can grow a company. You need to put yourself physically into a place, a grid, so to speak, of internet networks and a graph, so to speak, where the connections and the relationships you have actually accentuate your business. New York is a great place for that. Silicon Valley is a great place for that. I don't think there's other markets, but there's very few that are like those too. You know, they make you go faster. Your interconnections can be greater, therefore relationships and are formed faster and influences attention is provided more discreetly, and you grow faster. You want to get the deals first. You know, their network values. I was at TED this year. There's a great talk about is obesity viral? Can you actually catch obesity as almost like an allergy? And they looked at all data, and statistically you can. I mean, your friends and their friends influence your weight, you know. So in the same sense, your success is influenced by you and your friends. And so it's the same concept in your tipping point. There are mavens in your life. There are maven individuals. There are maven places to live. There are maven companies that can transform your entire outlook of your business. I experienced that, and I try to be myself. But it's very important where you are. So it's available to you if you're in Nebraska.
I've heard from people that have been at TED that they say that it's not like you don't actually get to meet people that much. It's more just like you tune into the presentations and then you're running off the next presentation.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. I should note that I'm friends with the founder and his wife, so I buy it. But I think it's the greatest networking event that there is in the U.S. I mean, there's no other place where you can roam around under security and see Bill Gates just hanging out, walking around, Jeff Bezos, the most powerful people in media. Just, and the talent in the room, people, is absurd. I mean, I was sitting down having a cup of coffee by myself, and when I sat down next to me, I talked for a half hour. I did a TED University talk 2 years ago on a concept called Board of Life, which we can talk about later, but and she came up and talked about how they influenced her a great deal. Her name is Amanda Briggs. And she's like the chief, you know, trend spotting officer for all of Nike. Like, where else do you meet people like that? And she's there, and they're there for 4 days. People just come and speak and leave. They're there fully engaged 8-10 hours a day. And you can meet anybody in the world who's there. It's just incredible. So people like on the outside like to criticize it sometimes for being a little elite or less informative, and they're just wrong. It is everything it's talked up to be. It is extraordinary. I hope to dinner
party. So you did actually go get to meet a lot of people. It wasn't just...
Oh, it's networking and steroids. It's so powerful. I mean, I have every day I breakfast and lunch. I actually invest in it quite a bit. I host a dinner party with two other founders, founding friends, Jack Myers and Mark Sinodell Letters. And we host our dinner party of 120 people. It's called the Tedster New Yorkster Dinner. Just to kind of do a small group and get connected, and it's worth it because you're building relationships. After doing it for 4, 5, 6 years, it just access relationships, and it's very, very authentic beyond learning, which is extraordinary. It is that. So I'm a huge fan of it. I've been to a lot of conferences, and I still do it, but it's very, I think it's one of the best.
did you go up and shake hands with Bill Gates?
I have about 2 years ago when he did, actually, no, the last from 2008. But yes, I mean, I'm not on first name basis with him, but he is very accessible and present, and he's an extraordinary man.
Was he there for the whole 4 days?
Yep. The whole time. As is, I mean,
did he look down at you and say, well, you know?
No, he's actually incredibly present. He comes across as quite sage and kind and thinks about very big ideas. And he's very direct and very confident, those sort of things. But he's got a very kind soul, and he says there's a lot of kind of urgency and importance to his work and for the Gates Foundation and energy and those sort of things. So, you know, he's a kind, but he's also a serious man. And so he comes across that way and his presence that way. But, you know, walking around smiling, he's got a great sense of humor, and he's accessible. And so, but I think people, are... give the more celebrity personalities there, the artists, the actors, the CEOs who are more well-known, the space, and so they get a chance to actually rest and learn and sort of stuff. But it's available to you if you want to meet them.
So, I just want to ask you just a little bit more about, so just being in New York, do you feel that's given you access to more deals and more info? You're around the Maven, you're obviously networked in. Has that, so you really feel that strongly has helped you a lot, has it?
Yeah, definitely. I've invested, I think, authentically in building very good relationships with people who, you know, are doing important work, and I try to cultivate that a lot. Again, you can't fake that stuff, that's the real. I feel like I have some of the best venture capital money in New York with the Even Square Ventures, Fred Wilson and Albert Venner and Brad Burnham. And then I have the Founders Fund on the West Coast in Silicon Valley, which are kind of guys who founded PayPal, formed the venture capital fund, and are the key VCs behind Facebook and LinkedIn and Slide and a bunch of great companies. So I've got access on both East and West Coast. They're very different places to build companies. New York is very media advertising rich, but the entrepreneurial community is very strong. And so, we're still a distant second from Silicon Valley, but I have to say that the startup community here is very vibrant. It's growing very fast. We're probably second only to Silicon Valley. We'll never exceed Silicon Valley. It's different, but it's one of the best, second best places sort of to build companies, perhaps. We're getting there. Silicon Valley obviously has lots and lots and lots of people who have built and sold companies, better entrepreneur base, better technology. I'll just say that I rarely have to travel. The good point is that, you know, in this next generation of technology with media and advertising driving conversations, that's all done in New York. And so all the major deals I do are in the city, which is a huge competitive advantage over the valley. But when I have to go do partnerships, like with Facebook and other places, I have to travel. I have to go see platform companies up there. So another way to describe it is they are building a stack of technologies and we're building on top of it. Now they're both expressing different types of value, but they also are unique and discrete in how they create it. So I'm very bullish on New York and where it's going.
If they're building the stack and you're building the on top of that, does that mean they're the ones that get the $1 billion valuations, you get $100 million valuations?
It's possible. I think it's a function of both the valuation of the company are both revenue and behavior. And so as people switch behavior into your network, the SAC becomes less important. But the SAC is always important for a kind of core IP value. So we'll see how that plays out. I mean, there's a great paper that I read that really shaped my thinking on just business and where it's going. It was in February 2006. It was called Eager Sellers and Stony Buyers, and it was in Harvard Business Review. And it described market friction. And so there's always an incumbent, a competitor entering marketplace. And so the incumbent has a huge advantage over the competitor in the sense that they actually provide a statistic that proves this. So take Google versus Yahoo or, you know, something as simple as insurance, you know, Allstate versus Geico or, you know, detergent, Cheer versus Tide, doesn't really matter. Dove soap versus, Old Spice, whatever. The point is that to get someone to move from one behavior to another, you need to convince them that there's a better ROI, it's unique, it's different, and it creates a lot of liquidity for them. So that's a natural 3x hurdle. But this paper actually proves this is another 3x hurdle that's compounding. So there's actually a 9x hurdle between Google, Yahoo, Geico versus Allstate, Tide versus Gerald's things, and the compounding second variable is user behavior. Okay? So the point is that it's extremely hard to get customers to switch to what you're offering. And so the only way to really defeat market friction is through cost. You can do it for free. You can make it easier, simpler, or you can do it for them. And so you've got to create a transom by which behavior and trends to switch. And so the way to think about that is, if you're in a switching business and you could get people to switch behaviors to your product, which is kind of like built on top of the stack, you can create tremendous, tremendous value. If you own the incumbency and you're building on the stack, then the stack has more value. And so depending on the marketplaces where you're in the stack versus the user experience, you can create billions or hundreds of millions of value depending on how valuable that is to marketplaces. So, another way of saying this is it's better to build painkillers than vitamins, okay? Vitamins are elective. Painkillers are required. Painkiller is worth 100 times more than a vitamin company. And you have to be able to solve these problems simply, defeat the friction, and create meaningful value so customers switch to what you're doing.
And so is that kind of your business often?
Absolutely. I'm in the painkiller business. I go into huge marketplaces where there's lots of pain. And I try to create simple, beautiful answers to that pain. And I try to create such demonstrable value that can be easily understood. And
the way you're saying it is what we would say from direct response is we, in direct response, we know we want to sell, do want to sell a solution to a painful problem. We don't want to sell a preventative. Preventatives are real nice, but people don't spend lots of money on preventatives. They spend money on cure.
That's correct. It's just a twist on that, where it's very similar to express the same point. Yep.
And something I want to talk applicable, but just before we do, I'm interested to understand your thoughts on how you define things. You're obviously a guy with a lot of options, and you chose to work with Fred Wilson and Union Square Ventures. You're working with the guy down in Silicon Valley. Why did you pick effectively blue chip money rather than cheap money? Because I'm sure you have a lot of cheap money around you, too.
Well, Fred and Albert and Brad at USV are incredibly pro-entrepreneur. They understand that they're in the talent business. And as much as, you know, they've experienced sprints, have kind of been in this business for a long time, they're very different from the Founders Fund. The Founders Fund is young guns, young entrepreneurs, were also pro-founder. But I would just say that in both instances, our third VC, by the way, is Firstmark, which is formerly PQAP and Rick Heisman. And so all, I would say all three funds who are involved with us all understand that building companies is an art than it is a science. It's very difficult to do it well. And so they've all built sole companies. Many of them have operated businesses. And so they're so pro-entrepreneur, and they understand the complexity that it takes a long time to build a company, that you know they're going to be there the whole path. And we're also very connected. And so between being connected and having a long-term vision of building great value gives you, enough air rooms to speak at the board level to deploy capital and spend money well towards solving these problems. And so they're not impatient, and they're with you. And I think I had good fortune of working with them. I did have a lot of choices, quite frankly. And I also did take, in some instances, a lower valuation to work with them, because it's better to win well with all your investors intact who are believing in you and get the win, so to speak, and solve those problems than it is to, you know, go for a massive valuation and not have your investors come along with your own success and be helpful to the business. So,
you're in Manhattan. There's plenty of old money there. There's Vanderbilt. There's Rockefellers. You know, I would imagine with the networking you've done, you probably know some people from the Rockefeller family. When I'll get some of those guys to give you money at a lot cheaper rate, kind of set their expectations in advance. Like, okay, Rockefellers, you're not going to get this money back for 5 or 10 years. You may lose it all. I'm already networking enough so that I can replace the networking that the blue chip VCs have, and we'll just do this way, and that way you'll make a lot more money, and so will I, and we'll be able to work.
Well, it's more than money. There's more than money. There's incredible advice that comes with that. There's contacts that come with that. There's accountability, knowing that, you know, there's a positive pressure in a company. You don't want to let your investors down when they're, you know, reputational makers in the marketplace. I think it's important that you have a board who's, you know, helping drive the business, that they're helpful in doing it. But we meet, you know, every month, and a company feels accountable to being a good steward of their capital. And we're a better company because of that. I wouldn't necessarily feel that, you know, if it was the Rockefeller money, that if we lost it would affect our life at all. But I know that the returns that, you know, Albert and Fred and Rick at Firstmark and the Founders Fund is on for, and they've entrusted that with me and my leadership, is real. And so I take it very, very seriously about how I'm building this company, that we are working in concert to create the greatest economic value for everyone around the table, all the employees, the investors, and their investors. And we're a better company as a result of that. We've done this before where operators, our investors are not, you know, all over us. I would just say that that sense of accountability drives this business, and we're trying to create incredible economic value and market value for everyone.
And so that justifies a low valuation, because you think in a longer term the accountability will help you get there, and then just the resources that they're in the table are going to make it a lot better.
Well, there's also, I mean, a low valuation, I use that, you know, in one instance. It wasn't significant, by the way, but it is, you know, material. Let me just say this, is that VCs, it's hard to build a company, first of all, but it's also hard to sell a company. It's hard to make money, period. I mean, you have to have the entire marketplace want to see you win. Your employees want to see you win. Your competitors in a way have to see you win. Your customers want to see you win. The company that buys you wants to see you win and be enriched. So you need incredible good fortune and luck and all those things stacked in your favor to build something that really dominates the marketplace. And so the conversations, the reputation that happen as well, your VCs engage with you, can transform the value, because they're having the kind of conversations with the investment community, with the corporate development officers of the companies, that sit down and look at their portfolio of investments and say, you know, it's almost like shopping. They're opening up and saying, here's what I've invested in. What do you like? And so if you're not part of that conversation, and or you're not getting a disproportionate amount of kind of influence in your speed, you know, it does hurt the company, unless you're just so good that you don't need any of that. And I think there are very few companies that are just so good that they don't need market advantage to grow fast. VCs don't make a company successful. I think they help make a company make better decisions and grow faster. And that's it. It's still, at the end of the day, it's about the magic of the entrepreneurs, the magic of the culture, and it's the magic of product at the right time in the marketplace. You know, that is the bet, but they do help, but they don't guarantee success. Raising money is not a material, it's a material event, but it just means you can start building, but it's not a signal at any means that the outcome is going to be a success. It's just empowerment.
Interesting. Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about Clickable? So third company, you've really focused on building a strong team. You raised a bunch of money. Tell us about what you've been doing.
Yeah, I mean, our marketplace, search marketing in general, as well as social, is a marketplace that is the players in the marketplace sell complexity. So they go out and they basically, most of the companies in the marketplace, describe how hard it is to do this, and then they sell solutions to that difficulty or that complexity. And, or they say that, you know, their knowledge of their technology is the only thing that can solve that complexity. And, you know, when, between companies, when I did a lot of research, I thought, you know, this marketplace is just desperate for someone to come in and just speak truth, to speak simplicity, to speak empowerment and, transparency. And, I want to express a lot of my work experience and, you know, in personal professional interest in those areas about creating a culture that's designed to solve those problems and to do it in a trusted way for companies. It's also huge, too. So there's a lot of room to maneuver. There's a lot of room to invent. It's not like one answer will solve every problem. You can have lots of different flavors, so to speak, or outcomes of the company that you can invent in that means that, you know, you can become something different and have great success as long as you have optionality in front of you. So, you know, a company growing fast needs to go in and create a solution to a problem, but it typically takes 3 years to really figure out what you have. You go with bias and you try to solve that bias, but the truth is you need to build backwards. You need to listen to the customer, look at the data, and build that. Let the marketplace rip the product out of you, and that's what we experienced. And after about 3 years of working hard and solving that problem and be capitalized, you're going to discover what you should be in the first iteration of that company. We're kind of there now. We're hitting our stride. But it's a slog. It's complex and challenging and high risk, and there's a lot of ways to kind of fumble the opportunity along the way. But if you keep the business solving this problem simple and you're not trying to blow the ocean, you can get to the answers and fast and create a great company. If Clickable is, you know, I admire Steve Jobs a great deal. I studied industrial design and fine arts as well as engineering. So I love design and beauty in product, and we try to be that. We try to create a unique, powerfully simple user experience across all these networks so that anybody can come in and experience success, and we give them recommendations. So our engine, we have a very, very sophisticated piece of technology called an ACT engine, which is about 100 algorithms, a bunch of quants built it, which just, you know, basically tells you how you're doing what you need to do every day, both quantitatively and qualitatively. They're just simple recommendations. But it's the hardest thing in the world is to do something simple. It's easy to make things complex. It's easy to add features and buttons and switches and knobs and language and words. But it's very, very difficult to take those tools out and just give the answer. And
so you focus on making it simple.
Yes. It's a very hard work.
So how do I pay you? So you'll manage, because I can obviously go to Google and Yahoo, Microsoft and run my campaigns myself.
Yep.
So how do I pay you? Is it a percent or is it monthly? And then why would I pay you rather than go and manage them myself?
Well, it's a percentage you spend, typically 2 to 5% of everything you spend on top. We get compensated that way. So your success is our success. Excuse me. The reason why I use this is because we save you time and defeat complexity. Today, people who are chasing, you know, the 100,000 companies spending between $2,000 and $100,000 a month in Google today are doing 5 jobs, okay? And so they have so much work to do that they have Google and Microsoft Excel open trying to figure out, you know, develop a beautiful mind, so to speak, on how to do this business well and make money. That's a full-time job. It's actually 2 full-time jobs. We make that 15 minutes a day. And we produce a greater economic return because we disrupt the complexity and we do it for you. We grab one hand of the wheel, you have the other, you own your data, we give you a brand new simple experience, and we, you know, set you on a course.
Like, I mean, customizing a Google pay-per-click campaign is pretty complicated, though.
It's very complicated, and we disrupt that complexity.
It's very custom. Are you saying you're doing it with systems rather than with people?
Well, it's a balance of the two. I mean, we give you the tools. Our recommendations will say, we'll actually tell you what to do. We'll look at your data and say, you need to change your ad campaign. It needs to be changed the structure. You need to add these keywords, you need to increase these bids, decrease these bids, all of those things, all through simple 2-3-step wizards. So after the first month, you've kind of reshaped your entire campaign by forcing these 100-plus algorithms representing best practices and the math, bid management, against the campaign. So we actually every single day run these analysis over your campaign data to enforce the best practices. We're defeating the entropy, we're making keeping the 100 balls in the air simple. By just holding them up for you. Now, you have to do a little bit of work intellectually, but the effort of identifying those problems in those two areas, we solve for them. We also have a group called Clickable Assist that if you just don't want to do it, we'll do it for you. So you can just hand it off to one of our teams who has a bunch of technology that actually allows them to do this well. So there's a nice balance between, you know, you having one hand on the wheel, us having the other, us having both for a period of time. The point is that we just defeat time and complexity. We make the average performance marketer bionic. Better, stronger, and faster than we really are. It's like
long term, like where do you end up? Like a few years ago, Web Analytics was a big area, and then Google just bought Urchin, I guess, and basically like removed that space. What's to stop Google doing that from AdWords, which, I mean, I guess we'd assume will happen at some point. They won't be allowed to do system to manage Yahoo and Microsoft, but maybe they'll do it anyway, and then suddenly everyone just uses Google doing what you're doing.
Well, they can't do that today already. It already is a choice. Any one of our customers is already using Google Directory. We're just giving them a different experience. And so we work very much in concert with Google's goal, which is to, you know, make these advertisers better than they really are. And so we're solving some pain for Google, which is we're expressing AdWords and Yahoo and other places, Microsoft and Yahoo in a different way. And so we're giving the marketplace choice. We're giving the marketplace simplicity where there's complexity. And so, you know, Google's going to make the same amount of money, but we make marketers spend more money with Google more effectively, faster than anybody else in the marketplace. And so that's a good thing. That's a good thing for Google. It's a good thing for us. We're rewarded by that economically. We're solving a major market problem for them, which is not everybody can be successful at Google. We make more people successful at Google than Google can on their own.
What's a typical, like a real success story comes through? Someone spending 50 grand a month and you get them up to 150 grand a month? I mean,
It's not only just how much money they're spending, it's how effective their goal would be in
that.
So, you know,
I'm assuming obviously that's not brand driven. That's totally profitable.
Yeah, it's conversion driven. Where's their goal? I mean, it could be downloading a white paper and be selling a product. And so the conversion value, the ROI, or the effective, you know, cost per acquisition is one of the key metrics of this. But what's important in the marketplace is that where there's lots of people selling lots of complexity is to just simply ask the advertiser, you know, here's a wildly invented question, you know, what is your goal? And accomplish that goal. 99% of the marketplace is simple goals. They're not, you know, my friend, the founder of Zappos, you know, has a million proxies selling. That's complex. Most customers have less than 10. They make them successful selling less than 10 products, all tagged and optimized simply. And do it in 15 minutes a day as opposed to 10 hours a day. And we do that. I think that's unique. We're also independent, so we're a third-party company validating the ROI across the networks, which, you know, that's very critical, is that we are transparent, and we're trusted, and we're independent. And it's a very, very valuable thing for this marketplace to have, is that someone saying, here's how you could be successful doing this simply, and be objective, as opposed to the network's own relationship. And there's inherent distrust, because the more effective and efficient an advertiser is in Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, the more money they make. So you have this, you know, you have an opposed market value with the advertiser and the network.
What's a typical client for you guys?
Well, we, you know, someone spending between $2,000 and, say, $100,000 a month in online advertising inside of Google, Yahoo, Microsoft. We have some guys, I mean, that's not the ceiling. I mean, that's the average, and we can go way up, and we have huge spenders, and we also have smaller spenders. But I think that, you know, kind of maybe the key KPI towards is, you know, are they selling, you know, do they have a complex goal or a simple goal? Again, 99% of marketplace is a simple goal. And so it really allows us to chase almost the entire marketplace while we're very disciplined in our targeting. We provide value for lots of customers. But, you know, the spirit of this is I want to, this isn't a clickable commercial, this conversation. I think what I'm trying to do is seed how we think about the world and being different and contrarian a little bit. You know, we're zagging, so to speak, for lots of companies that are zigging. You know, we're trying to disrupt the conversation marketplace on simplicity and transparency and community around solving these problems. And I think that our product is, I think it's probably the best in the world doing that today. And we want to, you know, while we're kind of a trusted and,
Let me just jump in because we're running on time. I want to go through a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself staying with search, or do you want to expand out to other types of inventory?
We're definitely expanding. You're going to see announcements from us in social in the next, you know, 2 months or less. We're doing deals with every major social network. We're doing deals with real-time networks, all those things. I can't speak to them, but they're, you know, confidential. But there's a lot of, we're going wide. We're going to bring value across.
More about other types of inventory, set banners or video or other stuff?
Banners, social, local, mobile, the whole thing.
So you want to become an ad serving platform.
We want to be the Apple ad management platforms. The serving piece is done with a kind of third generation technology. We want to be on the desktop of the marketer, helping them be great at this business.
I interviewed Frank Adante from the Rubicon.
Yeah, Frank's great. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. And the interview when we had it was about them building out an ad server to help publishers, and they were going to optimize. I think they cut the 9% of the spend, and be able to optimize and show ads more efficiently.
Yep.
So it's slightly different to what you're doing.
Yeah, they're the publishers that were the advertisers.
And advertiser driven.
Yep.
And I haven't spoken to Frank in a while, but I've seen just in the last couple of weeks they've made a big switch saying kill the ad server, like ad server no more.
Yep.
I don't quite understand what's happened there, but it seems like they're making a pretty big change.
Yes.
And actually, I'm going to be talking to Frank about it fairly soon. I'm interested in what you think of that and how that relates to what you're doing and how what you're doing.
They're unrelated. I mean, we are in a different marketplace. They're in the display inventory or just the brand inventory of publishers, and we're on the performance side of the marketplace for advertisers. A very, very different apples and oranges. I'm not really close enough to display to, you know, give you a highly credible opinion, but I think, you know, Frank is smart, and he's also got great investors behind him, so they're trying to, I think they're recognizing is that the publishers, the big, big publishers, are taking back their inventory. There's so much inventory. I think it was like 2.7 billion display ad last year. It's growing 10% a year. It's like Hubble constant, always growing, compounding. Is that there's so much inventory that pricing is going down. So even if, you know, Frank built the greatest serving technology, acquisition technology in the world, he's got very good stuff, there's so much volume through it that they can't affect pricing. So the point is how do you create pricing? You create scarcity. You have to take volume out of the inventory. And so those systems, better ad serving technology and better targeting doesn't necessarily make the ads better, it doesn't affect price. And so targeting, the best targeting technology in the world isn't going to necessarily, over time, going to be defeat the amount of impressions that are in the marketplace.
I mean, if you have his system doing a good job optimizing and they're able to get a CPM from $1 up to $1.50 by having a broader inventory of advertising to show, that's increasing pricing. I mean,
if I'm a Time Magazine and I'm using Frank's technology or his competitors, and you can increase that Reddit inventory from $1 to $1.50, but I can also just stop giving you that inventory. I can just say, you know what, I'm going to just sell less inventory by myself for $20 CPMs. Yeah, that's the transformation is the price, is creating scarcity. Selling less inventory in fewer places and selling it direct. That's transformative. And I think the trend at the large publishers is that. And so I think Frank is very smart. He's going to find a way to create value at the highest leverage price of display inventory, both at a market position and a technology innovation. You've got a great board.
So you don't have that problem because you don't have the inventory going wide. You just have to do a better job for the advertiser.
That's right. We're in a very, very different marketplace. And we're both bringing simplicity to a complex problem, but we're doing it from very, very different inventory stacks and very different type of owners, so to speak, advertisers versus publishers. Mm-hmm. But that's the guy very clever. He's one of his board members is a friend, Raj Kapoor from Afield, and I would bet on them, so they're smart.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. So let's say things work out really well for you and you're growing. Who's the sort of company that ends up buying your company?
It's the type of company that, first of all, there's a lot in our space who could be potential owners, so there's a lot of kind of natural owners of this company.
I don't know what Tony Frazzato does where he says, no, we're never going to get bought.
Yes, right, exactly. Tony's great, by the way.
I don't believe anyone when they say that anymore.
I think that we will be. I think that right now we're building a standalone company. You know, I think this company is scaling very, very fast. That's the night thought. We're gaining momentum. We're not just building into the plan. I think it's going to be leverage and compounding growth over the next 3 or 4 months, and who knows what's going to happen. But, you know, we're scheduled at 100 people in the next 12 months, and then beyond that, it could be a lot more. So I'm excited about this stuff. I would say this is that, you know, the purpose of Clickable, and this is something I talk about every, you know, month with the whole staff, is the purpose of Clickable is to help companies survive and thrive by making online advertising simple. Our purpose is to put food on the table, is to allow them to hire people and grow. And so while we have lots of partners who can use us and potentially buy us, we'll never do anything that violates that truth about us. Our customer is the business who's trying to grow, to put food on the table. We talk about this morning every month. And so there's very deep meaning here. There's meaning in our culture. We have very clear values. There are three things that we believe in. The first one is this rule called the 7-to-1 rule, which is we individually to each other and to our customers try to do extraordinarily more good than we do bad. And we admit that people, product, and data are not perfect. And we're incredibly honest and direct and transparent because there's no contempt in this culture. We are out there to solve these problems and do it transparently. Now, if you start, you know, that ratio starts to shift negatively, then you're probably not the right culture fit. But that rule, that belief, allows the spirit of the company to live out with a lot of kind of forgiveness, but also excellence. Our second value is the word simple, that everything we do has to be simple and beautiful. We have brilliant engineers here. We could build features forever. But if not simple and beautiful, from our legal contracts to our emails to our product experience, it's creating friction. And so everything has to be...
You use my hand without, like, basic print.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll say this last thing. Our third value is the word and. And it's a bridging word between two things that are typically opposed in companies. One is we love product. We have a huge product. 80% of our company's product. We're a true SaaS software service. And we have 80 engineers going to 150 this year. Now, I should say this, and we love sales. We love to sell. We love the customers, we love listening to them, we love learning about, we love closing deals. I spend 60% of my time sales, we're passionate about it because they inform us what we need to solve in the conversation. It tells us how good we are doing it. And it allows you to build it backwards. It allows you to listen to the customer, look at the data, and build that. And so we're both those things, product and sales, and we're very, very good at that. While we're good, transparent citizens of the marketplace, we're also very competitive. We're friendly, but we're competitive. We want to disproportionately win, dramatically. And our sales culture and our product culture allow us to get to those answers faster because we're unbiased. And so those three things guide us, 7-to-1, simplicity, and the word and. And that living on our purpose allows us to get that answer faster and grow more meaningful in the marketplace. So the natural owner question is, it's a company that is in concert with that purpose. I don't want to sell a company for money and then see it die or go sideways. It needs to have that live out. Just like, you know, Tony, you mentioned Zappos, his purpose is customer service. What's the greatest company in customer service in the world? Amazon. That's why they got married in a high price, because they believe similar things, and that'll be a very creative deal at a culture level. Our culture must be in concert with our owner someday. And right now, I'm not interested in owner. I'm interested in building a great culture around that concept, and we're laying it out.
We're pretty much out of time, but yep. Is there anything you want to add in that we haven't covered yet? Is there anything you would like to talk about?
I think that... I mentioned this concept of humanity's lottery in the beginning of the thing. I've traveled through more than 25 countries, far more than that. I've seen a lot of abject poverty and a lot of sadness and a lot of opportunity. And I think one of the things that I talk to my company about, I think it's a good reminder for people, is that if your purpose is about money or opportunity or self-interest, then I think the kind of karma and good fortune behind you is going to be kind of wind in your face as opposed to your wind at your back. I remind my team that as we are not every single day walking 6 miles for water. We have one humanity lottery, and as a result of that, we should give back. We should be grateful. We should be working hard. We have a responsibility to take risks. And that, you know, frankly, these cultures, a lot of these companies, they have no risk. I mean, no individual risk. You know, they're not going to go hungry. They're not going to, you know, their whole job really is to see, you know, how successful and rich they can get sometimes. And I think that those are the wrong reasons. I think that it should be really about purpose. It should be about culture and taking into account the good fortune and then finding ways to make that good fortune someone else's good fortune. So I think that it's woven into our ideas as a culture, and creating great things has to be that. That philosophy is more than work, and there's a gratefulness to that and values that that live out, that create personal and professional market value. So yeah.
I would agree, and I would add that with the caveat that have you read your friend Jacqueline's book, The Blue Sweater?
I had a 2-hour lunch with her yesterday. She's a very close friend. Yes. She's right around the corner. Yep.
I've only spent a little bit of time in Africa, but not much. But, you know, certainly know the third world, in the Dominican Republic, spending time in Haiti. And as you're giving back, please don't just give back. Give back the strings, or make sure that people are encouraged. As you talk about taking risks, they have to take risks. And their risk might be to invent something so they only have to walk 3 miles to get one instead of six.
Yep.
And that's, to us, looks horrific, but that's the kind of breakthrough that they need to be figuring out and getting excited about.
Yeah. And I don't mean that the spirit of Borne is not that we should be so lucky. I just think we should feel grateful. And I think that, as it relates to Jacqueline, I think her purpose in Ackman Fund, which we talked about at length yesterday, I'm involved with those guys at a number of levels, but they you need to create the system, so to speak, and the incentive for that those enterprises to exist so that they can teach others to fish, so to speak. And so that's grateful circles. We talked about, you know, giving back business. I mean, flying to Africa and being someone's house. You need to teach them, they describe, you know, that they own the house, that they saved the house, that they built the house, they pay themselves. The systems, the grid they're built on has to be built. And I think that is that point, is that they, you know, it's the sense of empowerment, ownership that will really transform this culture. So, you and I have a very similar philosophy, and I also friends with Jacqueline, Jessica Jacqueline from Kiva as well, and they're extending that same belief in the marketplace as well. So,
cool.
But it's important.
Yeah,
that's
important. Because I think all the stuff hasn't worked. Yep. The really nice guys that have done really well and just give lots of handouts, and the people are like, well, you don't have to work, it's easy to just get handouts.
And Millennium Promise is solving that as well. The creating systems, infrastructure, commerce, and one technology you really watch is the mobile device in Africa. I mean, that is an institute of commerce and communications and proprietary type of tools that's really could transform significantly.
Well, can I ask, and I know we had to wrap up, what cell phone do you have?
I have an iPhone, actually. I used BlackBerry for years, and I switched to an iPhone about 2 years ago.
Let me just respond to that. I've actually just switched from iPhone to BlackBerry.
Did you go back,
Before BlackBerry. And, well, I see this going back. I feel like I'm going forward. At least where I'm living right now, because over here, BlackBerry's plan, where you can text for free, means that with all of your closest friends, you can suddenly now text for free. Now, for you and I, texting is not an expensive cost that we're concerned about. But for local people here, that matters enough so they'd rather have the BlackBerry plan and use that. And so down here, your BlackBerry becomes your computer. And so exactly when you're talking about mobile, BlackBerry is here a really big deal. It's not an iPhone because the text cost is too much.
Yeah, well, you know, I am committed to user experience first. I mean, I think you're describing a infrastructure problem or a pricing problem at the handset level or at the network level. And I find that the telecoms are one of the great challenges of any good successful marketplace. But, you know, I want to be completely committed to one of the companies that's the best in the world at user experience. And so the nuance of behavior and user experience, the kind of beauty that happens in iPhones is really, really important for our culture to be engaged with so we can understand the user experience. So it's an important part of our growth.
Makes sense. Okay, David, thanks very much for the time.
Yeah, I really loved it, and I hope we have lots of reasons to stay in touch, and hopefully if I can be helpful to you and get great speakers, I'd love to do that. I know a lot of people will be great contributors to your efforts.
Thanks very much.
Of course.